Hi, everyone. I'm Emmeline Pat-Dahlstrom from Spacebase, a social enterprise focused on catalyzing the space entrepreneurial ecosystem, starting in New Zealand to solve challenges on Earth and beyond. You're listening to the Spacebase podcast. Today, I'm interviewing Professor Guglielmo Aglietti, or known mostly as Professor G, who heads the Auckland Space Institute at the University of Auckland. Prior to moving to New Zealand in 2019, he was the Royal Academy of Engineering Research Chair in Space Engineering and the Centre Director for Surrey Space Centre in the UK. Working on a range of topics from space missions design and delivery to hardware development, downstream applications, and education and knowledge transfer activities. His technical background is in aerospace structures and mechanisms. He holds a bachelor's and PhD degrees in aerospace engineering. His work ranges from academic research and consultancy activities for the ISS, the Space Shuttle Program, and numerous applications in various industrial developments and satellite systems in the UK space industry and internationally, most notably on space debris and space situational awareness. His academic work is described in over 200 publications and has been presented at major conferences. In this interview, we're going to learn about the plethora of pioneering activities and experience Professor G has done over the past several decades and his role building the space ecosystem in New Zealand through the Auckland Space Institute. Welcome, Professor G.
Thank you for your very kind introduction.
Yeah, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Really a pleasure for us to have you here. So I guess to start off, you know, you've been all over the place. It seems like you're a global citizen. Can you tell us about where you are originally from?
Yeah, as you can gather from the accent, originally I am Italian. I have to say that most of my working life, you know, 25 years, were spent in the UK. And when I arrived in the UK, I thought I have to leave, you know, I have to lose this Italian accent. But as you can see, it hasn't gone anywhere. But anyway, so my story again starts in Italy. I studied in Milan at the Politecnico of Milan, that is one of the top engineering schools in Italy, working on aerospace systems. And from there, then I moved on. I went abroad. I worked for the European Space Agency. Then again, most of my work life in the UK. And then here, more recently, in the last couple of years, I came to New Zealand. But the aerospace sector is a truly international sector. So it is quite normal for people, for professionals, to travel, to move to different countries, work in different organizations. So my story is probably not that dissimilar from the stories of a lot of other people that work in this sector.
Ah, great. Really interesting. Going back to your, I guess, to your childhood in Italy, for example, what were you interested in the beginning, which kind of like led to your aerospace engineering interest?
Well, I can say that when I was a child on TV, films and so on, there was a lot of that, now we can say, you know, sci-fi things. Yeah. And, you know, we are talking about, you know, let's say like the 70s. In those days, it seemed pretty, you know, normal to think that maybe by the year 2000 and so on, we would have, you know, bases on the moon. We would go back and forth to other planets and so on. So that is how I sort of grew up and where my interest started, you know, space was, if you want, the final frontier. And so I was always interested in that. And in parallel, I always liked to see, you know, how things were working, you know, like an engineer try to dismantle, you know, toys, the motors inside and that kind of things. So I guess that the two things, you know, came together and I followed an engineering career. And in particular, again, on aerospace, because for me has always been, you know, the interesting stuff, the frontier. I have to say that maybe some of the dreams of the 70s and so on didn't really materialize because the progress in the space sector that we envisaged in those days didn't really, you know, materialize. But again, I think, you know, in future, sooner or later, we will get to other planets and all those kind of things. It's just, again, a bit slower than what we were thinking probably in the 70s.
Yeah. And so one of the first, I guess, work opportunities that you had done was through the Italian Space Agency working on the Columbus module of the ISS. I mean, how did that came about? And how did you manage to get into the Italian Space Agency to begin with?
My first job was for my first job in the aerospace sector was for an Italian company at the time was called Thales Alenia Spazio, and that company was producing some of the hardware, some of the modules for the International Space Station. So that was my first job, do some of the structural analysis of these modules where the astronauts then, you know, live and make experiments and so on. And from there, then I got a job at the European Space Agency. I moved from Italy to Holland because the headquarters of the European Space Agency is in Holland. And then I started to work also on other projects, like, you know, projects for the, you know, with the Americans and the space shuttle program.
Yeah, that was also fascinating to understand that you had either worked on or supervised some of the experiments that actually went to the space shuttle. So can you tell us a bit more about what those projects or experiments are?
Yeah, in those days, there was a program, it was called Hitchhiker program, where it was possible to develop experiments in Europe, and in particularly overseen by the European Space Agency. And then these experiments could fly on board of the space shuttle for, let's say, in-orbit technology demonstrations and similar things. So in particular, in those days, I followed two experiments. One was about the sloshing of fluids in space, in absence of gravity, or let's say microgravity conditions, as you know, satellites, rockets, and so on, I've got these tanks, and to try to really understand properly the behavior of the fluids in microgravity condition is an interesting project, an interesting problem. So that is what I sort of worked on. And then there was another project that I followed that was on release mechanisms. And also that is an important area because all the time you have space structures sort of attached together. You have to change the configuration. You have to release, for example, a satellite from the rocket. You have to deploy solar arrays. So mechanisms are an important part of structural hardware. And so I started to get involved with all these type of mechanisms.
Wow. Yeah, that's really fascinating, like very pioneering work. And then from there, you went, to the UK to get your PhD. How did that leap go?
Yes, actually, after the European Space Agency, I moved to the UK, and I was working for a company doing, again, structural analysis, consultancy, on a variety of things. But because I had some spare time, I started to do a PhD part-time. And so I initially, you could say that my career was quite set in the, in an industrial way, companies, European Space Agency, but more on the industrial side. But then again, I started this PhD part-time almost as, for fun, and they got more and more interested in the research. And so gradually in the next few years, the center of gravity, let's say, of my activities started to shift from the industrial to the academic world and more involved into the research and education. And then I have to say that in the UK, I had the great opportunity to continue working across the two fields. And in a lot of countries, sometimes this is difficult because you either have an academic type of career where you do your research, your teaching, and so on, or you have an industrial type of career. You work in a company, you work on real products and that kind of stuff. And instead, I was lucky enough that although my main employer then in the UK was mainly a university, before it was the University of Southampton, then the University of Surrey, my job always had a significant part that was really linked with companies, industrial type of research, applied research. So I always managed to stay, across the two worlds. And for me, it has always been very interesting because I like the academic environment. I like the teaching. I like the research. But also I like the real things see how these things are actually, how the concepts, how the idea becomes, a real piece of hardware, a real product, and makes a real difference to the life of people. So I like both, and I could never make up my mind if I really wanted to go industry or academia. So I was lucky enough to be able to progress, you know, in parallel along the two paths, you know, an academic type of career, progressing through the various ranks from, you know, first job was teaching fellow, then junior lecturer, senior lecturer, reader, all these things. And in parallel, I was more and more involved with companies, doing consultancy work, truly involved with their work. And I was spending on average, maybe a couple of days a week in a company, and the rest of the time, maybe 3-4 days at the university.
That's really fascinating. Having a more industrial experience and background and then moving into academia, because normally it's like the other way around with most people. So you became the head of Surrey Space Center, which is, of course, a world-renowned R&D center for satellite development. Can you tell us a little bit more about the center itself and what it,
well,
what
yes,
it does?
And, yes, and I can tell you that actually my step from the University of Southampton to the Surrey Space Center was because I was doing, again, a lot of work involved with industry, and in particular with two companies, that, you know, Airbus and Surrey Satellite Technology. And I was in Southampton and working with these two companies. And Airbus and the SSTL, Surrey Satellite Technology, had a partnership with the University of Surrey. And so all the time that we were working together and I was in Southampton, they were saying, you know, it would be much easier if you were at the University of Surrey because we have this partnership agreement and it makes life much easier from an administrative point of view and so on. Surrey was not too far from Southampton. It's just about, you know, 50 miles. So eventually, after, you know, several years, I said, okay, I'm happy. I will move to the University of Surrey. And so again, I became director of the Space Center over there, and also Royal Academy of Engineering research chair in space engineering. So nice, a nice title, a lot of work, and again, a nice sort of step, if you want, in my career, because when I was in Southampton, my work was mainly in my domain. That was my, you know, my background, my domain, that was mainly the structures, mechanisms, and so on. And instead, moving to Surrey, I had the opportunity then to start to deal with all the subsystems that are really important in space engineering, because the Surrey Space Center, again, has got different, let's say, like research groups that they can cover the whole, all the key areas of let's say the space system, you know, propulsions, structures, robotics, the astrodynamics. There is also a group that does part of, you know, the Earth observation and applications. So again, gave me the opportunity to, increase the breadth of the things I was dealing. And actually, my directorship and my job was co-sponsored by the company, Surrey Satellite Technology, in partnership with Airbus, because part of my job, once again, was to try to keep together the academic work and the industrial research that was necessary for companies, because otherwise you have that these things tend to almost diverge. You know, academics try to do their things that are perfectly nice and interesting. I'm all for, you know, supporting blue sky research. That's perfect. Companies, they do their things, they develop their products and so on. But there is also a lot of stuff that can be done, you know, in between, when research institutions and industry work with companies. But it is necessary to maintain the alignment of the activities between, you know, company and university. Yeah. And so that was, you know, part of my job. And so also, once again, I was spending, you know, 2 days in the companies and let's say 3 days in the university, and again, try to keep the two organizations, let's say, like working together, because essentially you could say that the Surrey Space Center was a bit like a research department for the company. So this partnership was made in a way that we tended to do, you know, the research that maybe the company wanted to do, but not really in-house. And so it was a partnership where we both sort of benefited. And also from an educational point of view, the interaction is always useful. So you can make sure that what we teach at the university is really relevant for what the, you know, our students will do when they, you know, have jobs in industry and so on. So to be in a company sometimes, so you see what the needs are, what the people are doing, also helps to keep your teaching, your educational stuff, you know, fresh with examples, with real things. Otherwise, again, you have this divergence between what goes on in the university, what we teach, what we think, and what goes on, you know, in companies. So to do this, sort of keeping the two together is an interesting type of job. And I always enjoyed that.
Yeah, such it sounds like a really amazing environment to basically thrive in, especially in the space industry. So while you were there, do you have any favorite projects that you had worked on?
We tried all the time to do, you know, in-orbit demonstrations of our technologies, because in a lot of sectors, ultimately, you know, the deployment of the technology in the field is the important thing.
Yes.
But in the space sector, perhaps more than in other sectors, you can do all the tests you want on the ground and so on, but it's only when your hardware is really in space that will be, you know, the proof of the pudding, and see if things really work there, because the, you know, there are always some significant differences between, you know, the environment in which we do testing and everything here on the ground and what really happens in space. So for us to articulate, you know, these you know, in orbit demonstrations and so on, was really a key thing. And so during my period as director of the center, we managed to do four different, you know, satellite missions, three CubeSats, like, you know, 3U CubeSats, and one particularly interesting, which was a much larger satellite, that was this remove debris mission, that essentially was, again, a technology demonstration in partnership with various companies, where we demonstrated some technologies for the removal of space debris. And that was really a very interesting project. It was bigger than the projects that we would normally handle, with a lot of again, industrial context. We were 10 different partners, so my industrial background really helped to have the conversations and to, how you say, overcome. Sometimes there is almost a suspicion between the people that work in industry and the people that work in academia. There are really, you know, two different worlds that sometimes they speak different languages. So, you know, the fact that I have always worked across helped to keep the organizations together and ultimately the success of the project.
Yeah, I've heard so much about this, the remove debris mission, which is a really fascinating one. And of course, the topic of space debris has become a hot topic and a big challenge that's happening today. And if we don't manage it properly, it's going to be even a bigger challenge in the future. So I know that there's been a number of potential tech demonstrations on this to address it. But first off, maybe for the audience, can you explain what the difference is between like active and passive mitigation of space debris? And then
essentially we can start, you know, from the, let's say, like the beginning, and the problem that we are trying to address is that essentially through the years we have put together, we have put in orbit a lot of satellites that are doing, you know, very useful things. All of us use, you know, the sat-nav, we watch Sky TV, those kind of, you know, we rely so much on services that are delivered via satellites, you know, weather forecasting and things like that. But the unfortunate situation is that after a certain number of years, the satellites stop functioning, there have been collisions, breakups, and so now there is a significant amount of debris that are orbiting around, you know, Earth, and clearly they pose a threat for the new satellites. So we are going to go about this in various different directions. Clearly now there are guidelines then, you know, whenever you put in orbit a new satellite, for example, you have to think about how you are going to dispose of that. And you are supposed to solve the problem within 25 years. Your satellite either has to be come down and burn into the atmosphere, or maybe placed in a graveyard orbit. So we are trying to resolve, let's say, address the problem, you know, for the future. But now there are still a lot of debris that are currently there, maybe bodies that have been put in orbit, you know, 30, almost 40 years ago, they are still there. And so one has to go maybe actively to go grab some of these debris and then try to deorbit. So you need, you know, a propulsion system to go and chase this debris. You need means to capture this debris. And once this has been captured, you have to either deorbit together or find a way to dispose of this debris. However, there is also an alternative, which is, you know, on board, for example, of new satellite, you can have some devices. You can have, for example, like a drag, say it is called, where you open a large surface. This is the drag sail, and this large surface acts a bit like a parachute, if you want, so slows down the velocity of the satellite. This is because when you are in low Earth orbit, there is still some residual atmosphere. So if you open a large surface, although you think that you are in vacuum, you are not really in a true vacuum. There are still some particles of air. So deploying a large surface slows down your satellite until this then burns into the atmosphere. So these type of devices are really passive because you deploy the surface and then you don't have to do anything about that. As opposite to other means where you actually actively have to, you know, spend some energy, go and chase a piece of debris, capture it, and then deorbit it.
And so with the remove debris missions, I mean, I heard about those demonstrations like harpoons or nets.
Yeah. Yes. For us, what was crucial in the remove debris mission was to try to develop technologies that were really as cost efficient as possible. So we thought, you know, if this problem will be addressed, a lot of it will depend on how expensive is going to be to go and capture some of these debris. So the initial idea of the project was really sort of like the initial stages, like the brainstorming of what could be the possible technologies that could be used in order to capture in the simplest and cheapest way, you know, a piece of debris that is in space. And so it came out that things like a net can be a relatively simple way in which you want to capture an object that can have, you know, a strange shape, maybe has got, you know, flimsy deployables around, or similarly, another way in which you could capture something, it could be a harpoon. You know, you fire a harpoon and then you tether the body that you have to capture with your satellite. Clearly, there are a lot of other technologies that you could use, like, I don't know, a robotic arm. You could go and with a robotic arm, you know, capture, you know, a piece of debris. Yes. But what we were thinking is really what is that could be, you know, cheaper, the cheapest option if your objective is really going there and capturing a piece of debris. And so the idea to test the net and the harpoon was really to try to test some of the technologies that, in our opinion, were really the cheapest option. Mm. Because also whether or not these kind of technologies will be deployed for real and not just in a demonstration like the one we have done, it will really come down to cost. Because right. I think we all agree that is a good idea to go and start cleaning, you know, the pieces of debris that are currently in space. But one of the biggest problems is who is going to pay for that, which is, again, right. like the kind of problems that there are, I don't know, with the pollutions and plastic in the ocean. We all think, yeah, it would be a good idea to go and clean it up, but who is going to pay for that? Right. So in our opinion, although we couldn't resolve the problem of, you know, who is going to pay for that, but clearly, if the cost is lower, it will be much simpler to find, you know, the funds that will be then necessary in order to do these missions, rather than if the cost is really huge. Because if the cost to remove the debris is exorbitant, then clearly companies would prefer, you know, maybe to take the risk to being hit by one of these debris rather than have to pay to actually go and remove them. So a lot really comes down to cost. And that was why in our technology demonstrations, we focused on technologies that, in our opinion, were really the most, you know, cost-efficient way to capture space debris.
That's a really great point. And plus also, it sounds very sci-fi-ish to me, but it's great to actually hear that it's now been demonstrated.
No, yes, exactly. And I tell you that also, when we had the first discussions with NASA, because how the satellite was actually launched is that rather than via a launch share directly, you know, with a rocket that puts the satellite in orbit or a dedicated launch, what we did still to try to reduce the cost as much as possible was to launch our satellite as part of a resupply mission to the International Space Station. So our satellite was packed together with all the other goods that, you know, every month or so are sent to the space station. I don't know, water, things for the food for the astronauts and so on. Our satellite was packed in there. And then from the International Space Station, the satellite with the experiments on board was released via an airlock. Okay, so for us, in order to do that, we had to have the discussions with essentially NASA that administer, you know, the space station to make sure that our satellite was safe for the astronauts, you know, to take it on board and then deploy it. So the first discussions that we had when we mentioned that there was, you know, a harpoon, a net, and stuff, like quite, you know, surprised faces, because, you know, clearly the safety of the astronauts is of paramount importance. Right. And when you talk about bringing on board of the space station, you know, a device
like
that
a
fires
weapon.
A harpoon or launches a net, you think, wait, what if this thing is fired, you know, by mistake in the space station? So you can imagine that the safety implications and the fact that the astronauts had to handle, you know, the satellite that was, just to give you an idea, you know, 100 kilos satellite. So the size, we often, to let people understand, you know, the size of a little washing machine, so yes. Not really too small, which of course the astronauts can handle easily in space, as there is, you know, no gravity, so it's easy. But still, you have to make sure that the hardware doesn't pose any risk for the astronauts. So we had to make sure that whatever we had on board, and in particular, you know, net and harpoon and so on, were not really dangerous. And there was no way that anyone could, you know, inadvertently, you know, fire any of these devices. It would have been a bit, you know, embarrassing for the whole enterprise.
Wow, that's really such a great story. So I guess in your opinion, you know, is space debris mitigation and space mission responsible? Is it the responsibility of the launch provider or the space mission?
I think it's a collective responsibility, because you could say, well, the people that put, you know, these old satellites in orbit first, and you could say, I don't know, NASA, you know, the Russians, Chinese, and so on, are, you know, and all the other countries that actually put these assets in space are the main responsible, maybe. But on the other hand, there is also an interest from all the new satellites operators and people that put new satellites in orbit to have, you know, let's say a relatively clean space environment. So it is a shared space, yeah. And I'm sorry for, you know, the pun, but, you know, we all share it. And when satellites are on orbit, they orbit around the whole Earth. So they pass over our heads. So it's not a problem of a single country.
Yeah.
Clearly, it is a collective problem that, as you can imagine, presents some, you know, the difficulty to convince everybody to actually do it and to contribute in an appropriate way. So for all this, the discussions are still, you know, clearly ongoing, and there are certain, you know, countries, certain, you know, institutions, like, for example, the European Space Agency is quite keen in try to establish their, you could say, their green credential. Mm. And, you know, they are really actively now funding studies for a mission to try to go and capture some of the old satellites that they were put in orbit by the European Space Agency, satellites that did a lot of useful, you know, very useful missions. Like, for example, one of these large satellites was called Envisat. And again, was a satellite that monitored the environment for several years after clearly, you know, stopped working, but is a large satellite, is almost a 10-ton, you know, beast, the wow. size of a small bus.
Yeah.
And clearly now the agency is considering, you know, to find a way to, you know, remove that one. So there are, you know, institutions that are actually trying to address that. On the other hand, you could say that there are other actors that maybe are not really, how you say, as green as some of the others.
Right.
You might have heard, you know, more recent experiments where countries demonstrate, you know, the ability to destroy a satellite from the ground, launching a missile, which clearly produces many more debris, and all the space community is up in arms when these things happen. But unfortunately, we do not have a space police that can really prevent these kind of things that happen. You know, various countries try to put, you know, political pressure on each other so that we all behave properly, because ultimately, again, when we put new satellites in space, we are all collectively responsible and collectively at risk. So it's not just a problem of one country or another country, but clearly there are some, you know, dynamics in different politics going on that unfortunately sometimes make it more difficult than if this was left maybe just to the, you know, scientists and engineers and so on. We all would agree, you know, yes, let's try to remove these debris and so on. But sometimes there are also some, again, political consideration and other type of considerations. And so the problem is a bit more difficult to address than one would like.
Yeah, definitely. So in New Zealand, you know, as a nation with a culture of sustainability ingrained in its values, do you know what New Zealand is doing today regarding space debris?
Yeah. Yes, definitely New Zealand is you know, on the good side of this kind of argument. And although, again, we have the capability to put in orbit new satellites, but I think that the agency is really taking the sustainability of the space environment very seriously.
Yeah.
And this is very positive. And ultimately, because we want to continue to use space technologies in the future years and so on, is ultimately our interest to make sure that we don't produce, you know, more debris and so on. So I think it's a bit short-sighted to, you know, put things there and be a bit like ostriches and will be someone else's problem. Ultimately will be still our problems and our children's problem if there are so many debris that any new satellite you put in orbit, you have to do so many maneuvers to try to avoid these debris and so on that become almost uneconomical to use, for example, certain orbits. So we have a collective interest. And I have to say that the agency here in New Zealand is very sensitive to these kind of issues, which is very good.
Yeah, that's great to know as well. So speaking of New Zealand, so from the UK, you actually went to New Zealand to be the director of the Auckland Space Institute. And having now heard about all of your experiences with the SORIS Space Center, it sounds like a really great fit in terms of your role now with the Auckland Space Institute. Yeah. But for one, what made you move to New Zealand?
The reason why I decided to come is that really here we were still in a phase of, you know, strong growth, whereas in Europe, you know, the space sector, let's say, is quite well established. You know, there are some entities that have been playing in this area for like, you know, 30, 40 years. There is the space, you know, the European Space Agency that administers everything. So it is a great place, but is, you know, is very established. So, you know, there are a lot of things where there are a lot of cases where maybe to try to do something new, something different is not as easy because, as I said, there are established way to do something. Here, I thought that was, you know, again, because we are still in these moments of growth, there is still space for actually trying to do things in a different way and maybe best way, not because, well, now we have, you know, this department that does this, that department does that, we have to do things in a certain way because, you know, our company is structured in a certain way and we have certain, partnership with other companies. So there is, you know, that kind of you know, industrial politics, you could say, here is a bit, you know, is, I think, much more fluid. And therefore, there is more an opportunity to, you know, develop and also to do that kind of, path between the concept and the in-orbit demonstration much more quickly than, for example, where I was in the UK. Because, for example, in the UK, you know, the country hasn't got the capability to put in orbit, you know, new satellites. So you have to then find launch opportunities discussing with, you know, American companies or French or Chinese or whoever. And instead here in New Zealand, actually, for example, because thanks to Rocket Lab, there is really all the ingredients are there. And so we should be able to develop technologies much more quickly than in other sort of environment in other countries. And ultimately, this should give us the capability to really almost leapfrog the competition and jump ahead. So this agility that we can have really is what sort of interested me. And so all what I've learned and so on, I think, well, actually can be, you know, utilized here and again, try to do things, you know, slightly in a different way, taking advantage of all those lessons learned, because to a certain extent here was almost like having, you know, a blank sheet of paper, and you can actually design things as you think it should really work best, rather than, well, we have already a company that does that, a company that does that, you know, so is much more difficult, let's say, like to operate sort of in Europe, because it's not more difficult, but it's, you say, that there are, again, already so well established the sector that, you know, innovation, disruption, and so on is a bit more difficult than in a place that is still, you know, in a strong phase of growth, and these possibilities are much more open, like here.
It's so great to hear you say this, because it's really, there's so much opportunity, and it's so exciting that it's happening like today. So can you tell the audience a little bit about the Auckland Space Institute and what it's, you know, what it's all about, facilities and its goals?
Yeah, essentially, our main aim is really to help, you know, the growth of the sector, of the space sector here in New Zealand. And so we focus on activities that are, you know, research and teaching, because those are really two key elements. You know, you want to grow a sector, you need to have an appropriate workforce that then will help the growth of the sector. So you have to educate people, to teach them the basics, the kind of things that they need to do, they need to know in order to be able to do, you know, to make a useful contribution in this area. And also because when I arrived and I started to talk to various companies operating in the sector, the availability of people with the right background, the right skills, was really one of the main problem and the obstacle for growth. So we thought, well, after all, we are, you know, an academic institution, teaching is part of our main core activities. So we quickly put together courses and educational activities to address these kind of issues. And I have to say that there were also activities going on before I arrived, like the APSS, which is the Auckland Program for Space Systems, where colleagues of mine were already working with students to try to put together, you know, CubeSats and things like that. Yeah. So, you know, it's not at all started when I arrived. There were already a lot of things going on, but clearly, so the educational component is an important part. The other one, if you want to drive, you know, the growth of the sector, you need innovation, you need research activity, applied research, where you try to transform, you know, concepts into, you know, new hardware, new products, new services. So this is the kind of research activities that we are doing. Not really the blue sky research, although I'm all supportive for universities' blue sky research, because universities is the kind of place where is one of the few places where you can actually do the blue sky research, and that should be done, because for the long term of the, you know, the future of a country and the whole human race, that blue sky research is fundamental. But I like to work more in the sort of more applied things, and what is called the mid TRL. TRL is, you know, technology readiness level. Yeah. So when technologies are not in a pure concept stage, but also not yet a product, and you are in the middle where you want to demonstrate if a theory or a basic concept can actually be transformed into, you know, a piece of hardware or a service that actually does something useful for us. So working in that middle ground, and the kind of research that we do, again, call it, you know, applied research, because we are trying to solve, you know, real problems, to offer new services that could be useful, enhance, you know, our life. This is the kind of work that we are doing, and to support this kind of, you know, applied research, what we need is a series of facilities to support the development of hardware and services. So that is another of the activities that we started doing, you know, almost straight away, is to set up these, you know, test facilities, facilities for the deployment of the hardware, facilities then to run, you know, mission operations, because ultimately, if we want to do these things, you need to have, you know, an appropriate environment, a proper place where you can do these kind of tests, and sometimes do testing to prove that, for example, you can launch your hardware on a rocket without this falling apart, and you can operate in the space environment, you know, vacuum, thermal loads, and these kind of things. The kind of tests that you have to do are relatively expensive, because you need expensive equipment. And so what we thought is that New Zealand, as a country, really needed a place where all the various companies, startups, can come and do these kind of tests without every single company needing, you know, their own test equipment, because, you know, that kind of facilities and that kind of equipment is really a high entry fee to the sector. And so if we want to facilitate, you know, new companies from being creating, testing their new technologies and so on, you have to offer sort of support. And this support maybe is necessary only, you know, 1 week every year, 2 weeks every year. You know, companies need to do some testing only relatively, you know, now and then, but this is necessary for them. And so to have this, you know, a central facility in the country, and we are, you know, we are a university, so we are happy to support all different companies. We don't have a vested interest in, you know, supporting a company rather than another. So we are a neutral institution where, you know, startups, company can come and test their technologies if they want to develop technologies with us, as we have particular, you know, niche of expertise that we are happy to share and support companies. So another important part of what we do really in the institute is really this being like a central facility for the development of space technologies, where again company can come for, you know, a few days, a few weeks, whatever their need is, utilize, you know, our equipment, and then again go and continue, you know, their development. And this really facilitates their development than if they had to go, for example, in Australia or somewhere else to test. Because the situation before I arrived is that there was really nowhere in the country these kind of facilities. Yeah. And so, you know, if you had a startup and if you wanted to try and test some technologies before you launch it, you actually had to go to Australia to do this kind of test. And this is, you know, although of course it can be done, it makes much more sense to have this kind of facility, you know, locally. And ultimately, New Zealand is not really a huge country, but is large enough to actually deserve this kind of support locally. And so that is what we decided was really important.
That's really, I mean, definitely great for the industry and the companies all over New Zealand. So what is your long-term aspiration for the overall development of the space industry in New Zealand, you think?
Well, is definitely having, you know, is already, I have to say that for certain things is already happened, like for launching, you know, New Zealand is sitting at the table with the, you know, the biggest country in the world, you know, US, China, India, and there are a lot of other countries that have got a very well-developed, you know, space sectors, like, for example, the UK, but they don't have really the capability to launch satellites. So for certain aspects, New Zealand is already sitting at the top table. I would like us to be there also in the area of the, you know, satellite technologies, Earth observation. Clearly, there will be niches where we can excel. We can't be great at everything, but clearly, you know, I would like us to become, you know, one of these, you know, actors that are, you know, at the same level as other, you know, industrialized countries, like, you know, European countries and so on, for, you know, the development of really space technologies. And I think that for New Zealand, that would be good, because although, you know, in the past, the country has been really focused on maybe, you know, primary industry and so on, but you know, clearly, you know, countries have to you know, move forward, and space applications, aerospace applications are technologies that we use every day. Yeah. So we have to, you know, deal with them, and the better we become at that sort of game, at this sort of technology, the better it's going to be, you know, really for the population, for all of us. So we can't really engage with these kind of technologies. Because I can tell you, when I arrived, for example, and I was wondering why in New Zealand, you know, we have big universities, but in none of the New Zealand universities, there were courses in, you know, aerospace engineering or something similar. Yeah. So big universities, why there isn't, of course, and then some people, well, you know, New Zealand doesn't really have a big, you know, an aerospace industry and an aircraft industry, so there is no need to educate students, and then they go and work somewhere else. I say, well, listen, to me, is a bit like a vicious circle. Mm. Firstly, you could say that, well, If you don't educate people in that sort of area, then of course you'll never have those kind of companies and so on. But the other thing is that there are two other things, actually. One is that there are a significant number of companies that actually develop aerospace type of technology, aircraft technology. Maybe they don't shout this too loud because they are very focused at doing their work and people don't really know. But there is an aerospace sector that is actually much more developed and sizable than people might think. That's the first thing. The second one is that even if New Zealand will never maybe have companies like, you know, Airbus here in New Zealand or Boeing building, you know, big aircraft every day, but we still are users of all these aircraft, all these technologies. And if you want to be an educated user of the technology, because you are buying them from somewhere else, but if you want to buy properly, then you better know how the technology works, what are the capability, what are the cost drivers and so on, and then you get a much better deal. So even if one could say, well, we don't want to really build aircraft, you still need aerospace engineers because you will have to use those aircraft. You will have to service those aircraft. And if you buy the aircraft from somewhere else, you better know what you are buying. So I think, you know, there is no justification not to have an aerospace, you know, education establishments and so on. And so, again, I think that we sort of won that battle. And now in Auckland and also in Christchurch, you know, that there are new courses being established, which I think makes sense.
That's really totally agree. So my last set of questions are really more like your recommendations and kind of related to what we've been talking about. What would you recommend someone who wants to make their first step in wanting to be involved in the space industry in New Zealand? What should they be doing?
I would advise them again, either in Auckland or in Christchurch, to start to, you know, get in contact with you know, with educational establishments like us, for example, that teach these kind of things, so people can understand a bit better. Also, because there are people that, you know, hear about space and so on, and might think something, and then when you actually are working in it and so on, then you realize that things are maybe slightly different from what you had, you know, in mind before. So I think, you know, the first thing is that really people should come over and enroll in this kind of, you know, courses, outreach activities, educational activities. Also, you know, your organization is doing a great job to actually let people know that all these possibilities are there, you know, workshops, these kind of things where also, you know, younger students before university age, you know, high school students. But also lower level, they start primary. Primary school, because again, now, as I said before, you know, aerospace technologies are much more a routine thing. When I was a kid, was still this, you know, sci-fi, oh, we are going to have bases on the moon and so on. Now is a bit different because kids all the time use, you know, again, like the sat-nav, and they know that there are satellites around the Earth and so on. So they are much more, you know, satellite technologies are much more embedded in our life, maybe even without people realizing it. You know, they watch TV. Maybe they don't realize that the TV that they are watching, actually the signal is coming from a satellite. But, you know, now is that they are so in our life that it's much easier to also to talk to children and so on about space technologies, about these things. And then again, if they like to follow a career in this area, the sector is growing all the time. And even if in the last 2 years, clearly the aeronautical sector had, you know, with the pandemic, you know, we know that as air travel has been significantly disrupted, which clearly had, you know, a knockdown effect on the whole, you know, aerospace, you know, aircraft type of industry. But these kind of things are, you know, the pandemic will pass, and the sector has been growing for the past 40 years and is growing to go further. I can't really see these kind of things really plateauing. If you look at the number of satellites that are going to be launched every year, those numbers are growing all the time. The number of services that are delivered by satellite technologies, I think that the limit is really our imagination ultimately. And the more people that work in this sector, you know, bringing new ideas, also, you know, disrupting ideas, you know, the better. So I'm always keen to have, you know, conversations with students and so on, because sometimes they come out with things that are really strange ideas, but yeah. actually it's good because they can see things that, you know, because we have been set in a certain way of thinking, sometimes you don't have that kind of, you know, lateral thinking that a fresh, you know, mind can bring to the sector. So it's good to have, you know, new people coming over, also people moving from the space sector and then move to different yes. education technologies. Yeah. That's perfectly okay. Also in terms of the education, a lot of the things we teach ultimately can be applied to a lot of different, you know, sectors of the economy. So, you know, I don't see, you know, really the space sector as this, you know, like there is a perimeter around and there is this group of people separated by everybody else. I think it's a very yeah. porous type of sector with people coming and going and working in partnership with a lot of different organizations, because ultimately, if we want to do something useful, it's important to have the links to all the rest. Like, you know, you do a mission to monitor something, but then it's important that what you have monitored, you actually have the links with the people that on the ground can use that data. It could be people that work in the agriculture, people that work in the other sector. But so it is really important to have these links with all the other parts of the economy, as satellites are ultimately like a part of the infrastructure, you right. could say. And so it's important, yeah. this kind of networking, the kind of work that you are doing, it's really important to get all the people, you know, talking together and the network to really operate properly.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's awesome. So yeah, before we close, do you have any parting words or like insights to the audience just regarding anybody who's interested in space right now in New Zealand?
Yeah, I would say, again, don't look at space as this, you know, faraway thing where you can't get involved because only few people working at NASA and some other places are doing. Actually, it's much closer home than you think.
Yeah.
And perhaps, again, at the university that is not too far from where you live, there are some interesting activities going on. So try to find out. And I tell you that if when I was a child, when I was, I don't know, 10, 15, even when I was at the university, if people told me, you know, you will graduate, then you will go and work at the European Space Agency, you will work in the UK, and you will become director of the Space Center, then you will go to New Zealand, I would say, it's not possible, absolutely not possible. And as it happened to me, it happened to a lot of other people. So keep your mind open to the possibilities. And just again, don't be worried of, you know, walking out and talking to people and figure out, you know, what is possible.
Oh, this is awesome. Thank you so much, Professor G, for sharing your experiences and insights to the New Zealand community and beyond. It was a pleasure hearing about your stories.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to you and the audience.
Thank you. Thank you for everyone who is listening. If you like Space Business work and would like to support us, please check us out on spacebase.co. Thanks for listening and see you next time.